Damn.
Hello everyone, welcome to None of the Above. I'm your host Sam Trolley, and today I am joined by a psychology professor at the University of Toronto, Dr. Jordan Peterson. Jordan, thanks for agreeing to talk to me today.
No problem.
So, nice easy one to start with. What is Bill C-16 and why do you oppose it?
Well, it purports to add gender identity and gender expression to the Canadian Human Rights Act and makes discrimination on those grounds a hate crime under the Canadian Criminal Code. And the reason that I oppose it is not so much because of the bill itself, but because of the surrounding policy dialogue that's occurred in relationship to such things at the provincial level in Canada. So Canada has 10 provinces and a few territories, and there's legislation at the provincial level and also at the federal level. Legislation like Bill C-16 is already in place in five Canadian provinces with variants in a couple of the other ones. And the gender identity and gender expression terminology is very, very vague and poorly written. And one of the things it includes, for example, is the requirement that you address people by what have become known as their chosen names and preferred pronouns. Chosen name could be a nickname or an alternative name, but preferred pronoun is perhaps they instead of he or she, or any number of made-up pronouns such as Z and Zer, and there's a whole list of them. I can give you an example of a few of them here.
You're talking about the Ontario Human Rights Code, correct?
That's right, yeah. And so here's some of the pronouns that have been suggested. A, I, E, N, et, A, Han, Her, Herm, Hesh, Heshi, Hi, Himmer, See, Who, Na, Ni, Per, Thi, Rim, etc., etc. There's very many of them. And there's two things about that bothered me. One was the fact that I regard this as a form of compelled speech. That's the American term for the requirement that you use certain utterances, the legal requirement that you use certain utterances. And the made-up pronouns, particularly for me, I think are words that are the coinage of, I would say, PC authoritarians, very radical left-wing types, Marxists, postmodernists, most of them. And I'm not speaking their language. And the other thing that I don't like about Bill C-16, and this is perhaps the most pernicious element of it, is that it instantiates a particular theory about human identity into the legal system, and that theory is basically a social constructionist theory, although it's even a strange variant of that. Because the legislation also insists that that biological sex, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual preference are all very independently. And they don't. That's just a lie. It's not supported by any facts whatsoever. And so it's a profoundly anti-biological philosophy that's instantiated in the legislation. And I think even more so, it's an assault on the idea of objective reality itself. And I'm not being, I'm not exaggerating this. And the reason I'm not exaggerating it is because the doctrine in which this legislation is grounded, the philosophical doctrine in which this is grounded, is a hybrid of Marxism and postmodernism. And the postmodernists insist that everything is interpretation. There's nothing outside of the text. That categorization schemes are nothing but power games played by groups who are vying for power in the political arena. And that one person's subjective truth is as true as the next, and there's no truth outside of that. And to write that into legislation is, it's very, very, let's put it this way, it's very, very dangerous. Apart from the fact that it's an assault on free speech because it's compelled speech, apart from the fact that I'm not going to use the coinage of radical Marxist postmodernists who I detest, the notion that we should instantiate a particular theory of human identity into our legislation is ignorant beyond belief with a good touch of malevolence. That's what it looks like to me.
one of the great shames of censoring certain words and certain viewpoints is that you don't then have the opportunity to subject them to proper criticism. Is that a criticism you'd make of this bill?
Well, I mean, look, the other thing that happened here, so I made three videos on from September 20th, about the week of September 27th, and one criticized Bill C-16. The other took issue with the University of Toronto Human Resources Department decision to make mandatory anti-racism and anti-bias training part of the requirements for their staff. And the third one was a commentary on the PC game. And immediately, I mentioned in the first video that making the video itself was probably an illegal act, particularly because I expressed my intention to not use these preferred pronouns. And within a week, there were two demonstrations at the university, one definitely aimed at me and the other a free speech debate. And I received the first of two letters from the university telling me exactly what I had already said, which was that my statement about refusing to use these preferred pronouns was probably illegal. And I also mentioned in that video that the legislation makes employers liable for all of their employees' utterances, intended or unintended, whether there's a complaint or not a complaint. And so the university reviewed the Ontario Human Rights Code and the policy surrounding it that I had referred to and concluded, just as I did, that what I had done was illegal and that because they were my employer, they were also basically on the legal hook for it. So yeah, it's dangerous. It's so dangerous that you can't even dispute the legislation without immediately running afoul of this insane and dogmatic restrictions on freedom of expression. And I think the legislation is far more pernicious than I've even so far indicated, because it isn't obvious to me what elements of any discussion about the biological differences between men and women are now classified as illegal. I mean, I debated someone on a Canadian Public Television Affairs show, and he was a professor of gender studies at the University of Toronto, who forthrightly denied that there were any biological differences between men and women and said that that was the scientific consensus. And so I find myself in this absurd position where I'm on the hook at the university and the recipient of two warning letters because I stated that I wouldn't use pronouns, whereas a professor who can come right out and say something as palpably insane as there are no biological differences between men and women, that can just go absolutely unnoticed. So, and to me, it's part of this sweeping attempts by people who are politically correct authoritarians, and I use that technically because we've studied political correct authoritarians. They're very interested in censorship above all else. They're not like the PC liberals. They're a different type of person. It's a sweeping attempt by the PC authoritarians to regulate, I would say, every element of human behavior in the name of some hypothetical compassion-driven equality that's really nothing but a plain power grab.
Did you expect so many of your colleagues within the academic sphere to oppose you in the way that they have?
Well, it's complicated, because there are a lot of professors at the University of Toronto, and obviously a lot of professors across North America. They did scare up a petition that 200 people signed, basically denouncing me, although they didn't name me by name, because of course that would require courage. But when they sent the letter to the university newspaper, they said that it was aimed at me, so which I thought was pretty comical from a strategic perspective. So most of those were the characters that you'd expect, professors and graduate students from Women and Gender Studies and from the Ontario Institute of the Studies of Education, because education has become entirely corrupted by politically correct people. But apart from that, most of what I've been met by from my faculty members, fellow faculty members, is radio silence, and that's just an indication that faculty members aren't, I wouldn't say, all things considered, if they're not politically correct, then they're certainly not very brave en masse. So, but I didn't do this because I expected a lot of support. I did it because I was trying to straighten out my thinking about this particular topic, which is, look, it's a central issue, right? It's a central issue, this entire polarized political debate. Everybody saw what happened in the United States a week ago. And the probability, the reason that happened, there were many, many reasons, obviously, but the Rust Belt states, the old industrial states, voted against Clinton, and they don't do that. And the reason that they did that was because the Democratic Party, like left-leaning parties, I would say across Western civilization, have abandoned their identity with the working class to go off and play identity politics and to dabble in this horrible political correct authoritarianism, and they got walloped for it. But that doesn't mean they've learned. I don't think they've learned a damn thing from it, because I don't think that ideologues are really very good at learning.
That's something that you came across quite early in your life, isn't it? Because you, in an interview I remember, said you were once working with the NDP.
Yeah. Well, Canada has a pretty pronounced working class socialist tradition, especially in Western Canada, and that's done a lot of good. The healthcare system in Canada, which is pretty damn functional. I mean, it's not perfect, but healthcare systems never are. I think it's preferable to the American system. It certainly costs less money. And I think it's a lot easier on people. And it also facilitates entrepreneurial activity, by the way, which is quite interesting for what's essentially a socialist policy, because people have a bit of a safety net in Canada. They're able to go off and start small businesses at a rate that actually exceeds that of the United States. But anyways, there was a very powerful Western tradition of, I would say, English socialism that produced the healthcare system and also the Canadian pension plan and so forth. And I worked for the party that had put that sort of thing in place, although those were originated in a different province. And the people I worked for back then were people who did, I think, have the interests of the working class genuinely in mind. But the lower level party functionaries were driven fundamentally by resentment. And I figured that out when I was about 17 after reading George Orwell's Road to Wigan Pier, a book he wrote for the English Left Book Club, where he took apart socialism, despite the fact that he was left-leaning in his basic philosophy, and noted that most middle-class socialists, let's say, middle-class intellectual socialists, didn't care for the poor, they just hated the rich. And it's resentment that I see as the fundamental driving force behind the PC authoritarianism. It's jealousy of anyone who has any status or position or authority or maybe just anything more than someone else has. It's a peculiar definition, though, because most of these people, I think about this particularly in the case with the Ivy League university students who are PC authoritarian types. Jesus, they're so privileged that it's beyond comprehension. You know, they're already in the top 1% of the top 1% of the planet's inhabitants, both, you know, speaking generally and also speaking historically. And yet they concentrate their complaints on that tiny, even tinier minority of people who have more of something than they do. It's pathetic. It's beyond pathetic. Yeah. It's beyond pathetic to the point of dangerousness.
Have your political views shifted in recent times?
Well, you know, people have asked me this question before, and I do think this is the best answer. When I was a kid, a guy ran for vice president of the NDP at the provincial level when I was 14. I was very interested in a political career. And I think I have the personality that would have enabled such a thing. But I decided when I was about 18 that I wasn't going to do that. I was going to study psychology instead, because I didn't buy the basically economic explanations for human motivation and behavior that were being put forward by all the political parties. You know, because conservatives and socialists share something in common. They're materialist, and they also believe in the power of money. And conservatives and socialists differ in how the money should be distributed, but they don't differ at all in their idea that money is the fundamental solution to most problems. And I don't buy that. I mean, the idea that you could make people who are poverty-stricken, you could lift them out of their troublesome situation by giving them money is an absurd proposition, because poverty is a multidimensional problem, and lack of money is only one of many contributors to life at the bottom of the dominance hierarchy, let's say. There's alcoholism, there's mental illness, there's lack of conscientiousness, there's low intelligence, there's physical illness, there's structural shifts in the economy. There's all sorts of explanations for poverty. And lack of money is only one of them. And I know because in my clinical practice, I've had people who were strapped for money who were also addicted to one thing or another. God, as soon as you give those people money, they're just done. You know, one client in particular, I remember, who was a cocaine addict and an alcoholic. He was fine as long as he was flat broke, but as soon as he got his unemployment check, he was in the bar for 3 days straight, drank up all his money and snorted cocaine until he would typically end up passed out face down in a ditch somewhere because he just run himself right to the end of his tether. I realized that the idea that it was economic motivations that were primarily driving people and that economic solutions were the primary solution to problems of that sort. I realized that that was false when I was about 18 or 19 and I started to study psychology instead of political science. And that took me into the study of mythology and religion. And so I would say that I'm not fundamentally political, I'm fundamentally religious. And that means that I think that it's reasonable for me to state that my beliefs fall outside of the political domain for all intents and purposes. And temperamentally, I've got some elements that would make me conservative because I'm quite conscientious, but I'm also extremely high in trait openness, which is a creativity dimension, and that's the best predictor of liberalism. So from a temperamental perspective, I kind of fall halfway between the two poles of the classic political distribution. I would say I'm a classic liberal, I would say. You know, I'm an individualist, but the idea that we should be fundamentally defined by our group identities, I find abhorrent to the point of treason. I think it's an unbelievably dangerous doctrine, and I think that the historical evidence for that is crystal clear.
You define yourself as a classical liberal there. So it must be incredibly disheartening for you to hear fellow self-identified liberals accuse you of abusing students, being a purveyor of hate speech, and of being a transphobe because of your opposition to Bill C-16.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a lot easier to call people names than it is to think and discuss. And, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting about what's happened over the last month, I mean, it's been crazy, right? It's been almost 6 weeks now or 7 weeks. We counted the other day, my son is helping me keep track of this, being 134 newspaper articles on this, and an immense YouTube upswelling of interest, and which hasn't receded in the least so far. Is it disheartening? Not really. None of this really comes as a surprise to me, although every day I read something that brings the level of surreal absurdity to a new point. You know, I found the other day something called the Gender Unicorn, which was it's an animated character designed to appeal to young children. That it's a piece of propaganda aimed at very young kids to teach them that biological sex, gender identity, gender expression, and sexual interest are independent constructs. So that's nice. That's nice. Why not aim your bloody ideological propaganda at people who are too young to distinguish between one theory and another? Get the kids young. That's the right thing to do. And let's do it in the name of education. And then I read today that New York State has now hired 50 policemen to police. They have an anti-bias hotline that you can call, and they put 50 police officers on it. And they've even mentioned bias perception as a potential reason for having the biased police knock on your door. And that's a logical extension, as far as I'm concerned, of the New York State legislation that makes it a crime to not use someone's preferred pronoun when they request it, and a fine of up to $250,000. I mean, the absurdities just pile one on top of the other. It really reminds me of, well, it's such a strange thing. It's a strange hybrid. What's happening right now is a strange hybrid between Animal Farm, Orwell's book, 1984, Orwell's book as well, and Brave New World. It's like we're managing to bring both totalitarian dystopias into existence at exactly the same moment. It truly feels surreal to me. It's like being in a Dali painting or a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It's so crazy. But it's not that surprising, because I mean, I've been studying totalitarianism for four decades, and I know how crazy this can get. And this is only, like, this isn't as crazy as it can get, that's for sure. So it would be good for people to wake up, because what's happening on the fringes of the radical left is seriously, seriously, seriously not good.
How crazy do you think it will get?
There's no limit to crazy. You know, I mean, the only thing I can say to that is to look at the historical evidence. I think the best parallel to this is the few years before, right after the Russian, in the time just surrounding the Russian Revolution, maybe 10 years before that in Russia, because these ideas, exactly the same sets of ideas, were beginning to be promulgated in Russia in the late 1800s. If people are interested in that, I would recommend in particular reading Dostoevsky's book, The Possessed, or The Devils, depending on the translation. It's a little hard to get into. Dostoevsky's books often are, because there's multiple characters and they're quite complex. But The Devils describes in perfect detail the possession of young people in particular by this kind of radical, this ideology that's predicated on radical, say, equality of outcome and pure subjectivity. How crazy can it get? There's no limit. I mean, you know, ideas of this sort, Marxist ideas in particular, killed, the estimates vary from, say, 20 to 60 million killed in internal repression in the Soviet Union between 1919 and 1959. And that doesn't count like the Second World War. That's just pure internal repression. 6 million Ukrainians starved to death in the 1930s. That was part of that. And in China during the Cultural Revolution, again, we don't know how many people, between 60 and 100 million. And there's no limit to the amount of crazy that this can become. So, for example, with this anti-bias hotline that New York State is promoting, I mean, the Soviets had all sorts of systems set up where you could inform on your friends, your colleagues, your family. You know, they elevated children who informed on their parents to the status of national heroes. And in East Germany, at the height of the Cold War, one out of three people was a government informer. And so that meant no one ever told the truth about anything to anyone. It was an absolute catastrophe. And these ideas are making, the Alberta Teachers Association, Alberta is a province in Canada, and quite a conservative province at that. The Alberta Teachers Association, who was promoting this gender, bloody gender unicorn, actually recommended that children call one another comrade, because it wasn't a gendered form of description. And I don't even know how to respond to that when I see something like that. I mean, what sort of person would recommend that? So there's only two things I can see. You have to be historically ignorant beyond comprehension, or you have to be malevolent beyond belief. And then strategically, you're also a fool, because you think of all the things that you wouldn't do if you're trying to sneak your language control, you know, by the even semi-educated population. The last bloody thing you do is pipe up with your preference for the word comrade. It's just, well, that goes back to the element of surrealism. Yeah, it's who would have guessed that this could, who would have guessed that after that, what is it? It's 17 years, it's how many years after the wall fell, 1989, how long ago is that? Almost 30 years, say, 27 years. 27 years after the Berlin Wall fell, after we fought a Cold War to defeat communism and damn near put the whole planet to the torch, right? Because with our 100,000 nuclear weapons aimed at each other, what's happening? There's a radical comeback of Marxist ideology. The University of Toronto Human Resources Department, their mandatory anti-racism and bias training, the consultant that came in, this is what she did. And she served as a consultant to many organizations in Canada. She defined equity, because it's human resources and equity. And I'm concentrating on the human resources people, because they're like the fifth column in most corporations. God only knows how that happened, but it did. So it's HR, human resources, and equity. So the question is, well, what's equity? Because it's not equality, right? It's obviously something different. Well, she defined equity. So take an organization and stratify it at its different levels of power, then assess each level of power, then determine if the group identity representation at that level, at that strata, is identical with the general population. So maybe that would be, it'd have to be two, let's say 1 to 2% homosexual. I don't know how, what the percentage of the black population in Canada is. It's quite low. Maybe it'd be 10% Native American. It'd be 51% women, etc. If the organization doesn't mirror the population structure at every level, then the organization is corrupt and needs to be retooled, because equity was defined by this consultant as equality of outcome. Really, equality of outcome. They're so brazen now, these PC authoritarians, that they're not even hiding the worst elements of their terminology. There's nothing, I can't think of anything you could possibly do to a society that would corrupt and destroy it more rapidly than to insist on equality of outcome. So, yeah, and yet this is what the university administration is teaching by force to its staff. And, you know, that's just the beginning, right? Because they're trying it out on the HR and equity staff. There's already demands from the radical fringe groups that the HR people have allied themselves with to do the same thing for professors and students. And so it's a trial balloon. If it sails with no problem, then, you know, it'll expand past HR and equity.
Is this why you said in an interview that universities have been corrupted beyond redemption?
Yes. And I thought about that. I'm trying to figure out what to do about that. One thing I've thought about is the government should cut university funding by 25% and make the faculty and administration fight it out and make them decide, what is it going to be? Is it going to be science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, disciplines with a solid empirical grounding and with something outside of theory? Or are we going to keep funding the bloody social justice warriors and what, enabling a fifth column to invade the rest of society? It's like, I think people should, I believe the universities now do more harm than good, with the exception of the hard science end of things. So it's, I mean, I have no idea what the right solution is. I would say to people, quit donating money to universities. Rich people, stop doing it. The universities are not your friends. Write the damn universities out of your will. And I would tell parents, don't send your kids to university. Send them to college, send them to trade school. Or if you send them to university, put them in the sciences. But the sciences are next on the hit list for the social justice warriors, especially in biology.
Why do you say that?
Because the doctrine that is being instantiated in the legislation is profoundly anti-biological. Look, if you can think about this, if you can question the idea that there are biological differences between male and female, and I don't just mean men and women, because the more radical people, I read an article recently that claimed that the idea that there are differences between male and female animals is only a projection. It's only a theory. It's an imaginary projection. We're just reading it into their behavior. If you can question the existence of biological differences between men and women, the necessary next step from the perspective of logical necessity is to question the epistemological validity of biology itself. You can't just throw away a piece of something, say, oh, well, we're not going to believe that. It's like the fundamentalist Christians saying, well, we'll accept science, but not the theory of evolution. It's like, no, you don't get to do that. That isn't how it works. You can't throw away the idea of biological differences between men and women without throwing away the idea of biology. And like, the thing about philosophy that's embedded in legislation is that it unfolds of its own accord, in keeping with its logical, with the logic of its presuppositions. Because a law is a living thing. It's a machine. And it's like you put a punch code into a complex computer. If you put a program into a complex computer, the program is going to unfold inside the computer in keeping with its internal logic. The same thing applies to legislation. And if your listeners want to learn about that, the best source for understanding that is Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. Because what Solzhenitsyn did with the Gulag Archipelago, which was the book that promoted him up to the ranks of Nobel laureate, I mean, he wrote many other great books, but this one is an absolute masterpiece. It's probably the most important book written in the 20th century. And, you know, I mean, you could argue about that, but it's definitely in the top 10. Many left-wingers, especially the damned French intellectuals like Sartre, who didn't denounce communism until like 40 years after anybody with a conscience would have done it. The claim has been made and is still made by people on the radical left that what the Soviets did and the Maoists did and the Vietnamese did and the Cambodians did and the Koreans did was a perversion of the actual underlying pristine and pure Marxist doctrine, and that genuine Marxism has never been tried, and which I find is a reprehensibly narcissistic and arrogant claim, because what it really means is if I was in charge of the communist country, none of this horrible murder would have happened. It's like, well, don't kid yourself. You're not that much of a saint. But what Solzhenitsyn did was link the philosophical doctrine that was embedded in Marxist writings to the development of the legislation, to the genocides and the imprisonments and the torture, and he showed how all of that flowed logically from the initial presuppositions, from each according to his ability to each according to his need, which sounds like it's a doctrine of pure compassion on the surface. It's very attractive rationally, especially if you're fundamentally driven by compassion, but it turns out to be an absolutely murderous doctrine, as does the doctrine that human identity is nothing but a social construct, which is palpably false. And so if you're also going to instantiate social constructionism into legislation, then that's another place where you wipe out biology. And once you wipe out biology, there's an assault underneath that on the idea of the objective, period. And there's lots of people already who are claiming that like science is nothing but an arbitrary Western construct. And so even physics. And someone sent me a description of a new module for physics education for grade 9 students, where it's social justice physics, which was another one of those events that made me feel like the whole universe had shifted and I was in a surreal place. And so instead of teaching children physics, the module taught them how physics was exclusionary because most of its practitioners were male and Caucasian. I think most of them are still Caucasian, though obviously the Asians are coming up big on the physics front. So there's nothing safe from this doctrine. It's at its very base, it's an assault on the idea of objective reality. And there are more pernicious things underneath that. It's an assault on the idea of category. It's an assault on biology. It's an assault on free speech. It's an all-out assault on the foundational structures of Western civilization. And by no accident, I mean, if you go look at the dozen women's studies websites, go to the Berkeley, go look at the website for Princeton, go look at the big universities, and what you'll see is that, and these, you know, the gender studies people are on the vanguard of this sort of movement, is that Western civilization is a corrupt, autocratic, oppressive patriarchy, and it should be dismantled and demolished. It's like, and we're training activists to do just that. So it's not like I'm making this up. Anybody with eyes to see can go onto the websites and read exactly what the stated intent and background philosophy are of the people who are doing this. And we're subsidizing that. We're completely out of our minds. It's completely insane to be subsidizing that.
Do you think that people who would otherwise criticize the things that you have now may feel inclined to self-censor themselves or to bite their tongue?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've got at least 1,500 letters so far, and I would say 1,000 of them have been multi-page letters. And I'm going to release them, by the way. I'll put them. I'm making an anti-politically correct website, and I hope to have it up in a couple of weeks. I'm going to release all these letters because they've been unbelievably thoughtful. I only received one letter out of 1,500 from someone I would say that was on the radical right. And he was a self-professed Nazi who thanked me because I can't remember exactly what his rationale was. Doesn't matter. But anyways, I've received all the other letters have been from from reasonable people, and many, many of them have been from people on the left. I think I received 20 from transsexual people who told me that they were happy about what I was doing because they didn't want an all-out assault on the idea of gender. Many, many of the letters tell me that they're from people who are afraid to speak up and who have been persecuted in one way or another at work. And many people have come to me privately and said, oh, you know, we're really happy about what you're doing, but we're afraid to say anything. I had one of the members of the staff at the University of Toronto came into my office yesterday and told me exactly that. And, you know, yes, there's absolutely no doubt that people are afraid. And no wonder. I mean, in the first 2 weeks that this happened, I was quite stressed about it because, first of all, I didn't expect this bloody explosion to take place. Like, who would have guessed that, you know? And then I had no idea the degree to which my job was in danger, and I still really don't know about that. So, and, you know, then there was this, there's an assault, roughly speaking, a conceptual assault from all the people on the left at the university. The university has been driven to apologize for even hosting this debate because the bloody PC authoritarians regard, you know, some columnist blog posted at Huffington, the Huffington Post in Canada yesterday, saying that the university caved in to my demands for a debate. It's like, there was no demand. I went to the dean after they sent me a warning letter and I said, look, there's obviously something worth talking about here because there wouldn't be a million people watching the free speech rally video where Lauren Southern was the journalist, a young female journalist, was assaulted by a professional activist type. There's obviously something that needs to be discussed publicly here. Why don't we actually talk about it and see if we can sort it out a little bit? And the university, you know, the administrators went off and had a colloquy and agreed. But that's okay. The PC authoritarians, they can come out and say, oh, well, you know, you're giving Peterson and his radical views a platform, even though half the speaking time will be devoted to their position. It's a perfectly fair forum. You know, and then they lie and say, well, a bunch of lies. One is that I demanded this and the university caved in, which could not possibly be farther from the truth. And then there's another lie rumor circulating around the University of Toronto that I got wind of this from someone who's highly placed in the administration, that the reason this all started was because a student asked me to use their preferred pronoun and I refused, which is also a lie. That never happened. That's a lie. And what happened was that I read the damn legislation policy that was on the Ontario Human Rights Commission website, and it made my hair stand on end for all the reasons that we've discussed. And since in the 6 weeks following, I thought far more about this, I think the legislation is much more dangerous and pernicious than I had originally concluded, because it didn't strike me initially. What really bothered me initially was the requirement that I would have to use the words of radical left-wing Marxist postmodernist activists, because I can't tell you how dangerous I believe those people to be. And I believe that my sense of that danger is informed by my extensive knowledge of the development of totalitarian and authoritarian political movements. I wrote a book called Maps of Meaning back in 1999, and it took me 15,000 hours to write that book. I spent 3 hours a day for 15 years doing nothing but writing that book and doing the research that was necessary to it. And it's a study of ideology and religious belief and the way that ideologies turn into murderous totalitarian regimes. Now, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought there momentarily. I was telling you that for a reason. Oh, yes. Well, it had to do with the danger of this particular position and the lies that go along with it. You know, so the PC authoritarians, doesn't matter if they lie as far as they're concerned, as long as it promotes their ideology, because a lie that promotes their ideology is the truth. So
let's talk about Bill C-16 again for a bit, because there are a number of criticisms you've received, and I would I hope you'll be able to address some of them here.
Sure.
The first criticism I've heard is legal issues aside, why doesn't Dr. Jordan Peterson refer to trans people by their preferred pronouns as a matter of courtesy? What would you say?
No, it's not a matter of courtesy. I think that's a really good question. And, you know, that's the thing that I was hit with to begin with. It's like, why can't the mean professor just play nice? It's like, okay, all right. So we think about that for a bit. Okay, so there's a bunch of propositions that underlie that claim. The first is that using someone's pronoun is a mark of respect. That's not true. Now, it took me a while to formulate this, because if someone comes up to you on the street and says, why do you use pronouns? It's like, you're taken aback. How the hell do you know? Why do you use he and she? Because everyone does. And that's how language works, right? You do what everyone else does. That's, otherwise your language wouldn't be comprehensible. So why do we use he and she? Turns out I actually don't know. Not at a deep level. So it took me like 3 weeks to think this through. First of all, my referring to you as he has zero to do with respect. It is the most perfunctory and casual form of classification possible. It seems to be predicated on the idea that indicating someone's sex is a fundamental necessity, because otherwise it wouldn't become instantiated in the language. But there's 4 billion he's and 4 billion she's. And so when I refer to you as he, I'm referring you to a member, referring to you as a member of a very large herd. It has nothing to do with respect. It's just casual classification. And it's basically pragmatic in its orientation. And so the idea that when I call someone he or she, it's a mark of respect, that's not true. The next issue is, well, what if someone wants to be called something different than what everyone else wants to be called? Not my problem. And first of all, if I'm going to interact with you casually, you can't impose a restriction on how I'm going to do that. Why would I bother even interacting with you then? There's billions of people out there that I could hypothetically interact with. And I don't see that you have any right whatsoever to demand from me any particular type of linguistic preferential treatment. And you certainly have no right to demand from me my respect. I don't know if you're respectable. And if you're a left-wing ideologue, the probability that you're respectable is zero. So, and then there's another issue here. It's, well, what about, yeah, but you're treading on my identity. And in the legislation, this is another pernicious element of the legislation, a very, very, very dangerous presupposition. The idea is that identity, well, we'll say gender identity to begin with, but the larger issue is identity, because gender identity is an element of identity. So I'm just going to talk about identity. The legislation insists that your identity is subjectively defined, and only subjectively defined. It's subjectively defined to the point where it can be divorced from any underlying biological or objective reality. And it's subjectively defined to the point where it can be entirely mutable. So you can be a boy one day and a girl the next, or a boy 1 hour and a girl the next. In fact, I know that some people have taken to wearing bracelets so that their friends can tell whether they're female or male that day. And, you know, then I thought about identity. It's like, wait a minute. Psychologists have studied identity for a very long time. Identity isn't defined subjectively. That's an insane proposition. So here's what identity is, roughly speaking. There's your conception of yourself. That's not your identity. That's your theory about your identity, actually. So, but we'll leave that aside just for a moment. We'll focus on identity. Well, your subjective sense of who you are is only a tiny fragment of your identity. Your identity is a negotiated construct. It's who you present yourself as, but it's also who other people have agreed that you are. And if you're a civilized person, you negotiate that. So, you know, your family, for example, has different opinions about your identity than you do, and that often causes a substantial amount of conflict. But that doesn't make you right and them wrong. Like, if they think you're being an annoying son of a bitch, they might tell you that, and it's possible that you are, even though your self-concept might not include that. And then, so there's the interpersonally negotiated element of identity. which is paramount to its existence. But then there's something that's even more fundamental, more associated, I would say, with objective reality, which is that if you have a functional identity, it's a vehicle in which you travel through life. So, for example, if you're a father, which is part of identity, let's say, then you play a particular kind of social, you have a particular sort of interpersonal and social purpose. Like it's practical machinery. If you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, if you're a professor, if you're a baker, those are all parts of your identity. And those are parts of the toolkit. They're parts of the toolkit that you use to interact with the natural and the social world. And so the idea that your identity is your subjective whim, that no one else has anything to do with it, that no one else has a right to comment on it, that it's completely divorced from biology and objective reality, is, and I'm speaking as a psychologist here, it's the philosophy of a poorly socialized two-year-old. And the reason I'm saying that is because two-year-olds are egocentric. They don't know how to play with other kids yet. Even three-year-olds have trouble with that. But between two and four, there's a developmental shift. And two-year-olds who are fundamentally egocentric learn how to expand their circle of comprehension so they can take other people's viewpoints into account. And then they can start to play shared games. And when you can play shared games with others, well, then the roles that you play in those games are defined by you and others in negotiation, and then you're acceptable to your peers. You can start being socialized by your peers, and you can enter general society. So most people learn that identity is not subjective between the ages of two and four, and the evidence also suggests very strongly that if you don't learn that by the time you're four, you'll never learn it ever again in your entire life, because you get thrown outside the peer groups, and then you don't get socialized properly. So no, it's not a mark of respect for me to use your damn pronoun. It's a mark of your massive narcissistic power grabbing to insist and then put the full force of legislation behind the demand that I call you anything you want. And that doesn't even touch on the potential multiplication of identities far beyond they into this insane proliferation of gender identities, which is up to about 70 now, I believe, on Facebook. And that means we haven't even started to talk about the insane problems posed by people like otherkins who claim non-human identity. And if identity is only subjective, it's like, well, who are you to say? Maybe I'm an elf. Maybe I'm a fairy. Maybe I'm a puppy dog. Maybe I'm a bear. And I'm using those particular appellations because there are groups who are claiming exactly that. And you say, well, that's just make-believe. And they say, you have absolutely no right to say that. It's like, well, if there's no grounding underneath identity, then it's whatever you want it to be. Well, it's almost impossible to enumerate the number of ways that's wrong. And it's dangerously wrong, apart from being totalitarian. I have to address you the way you want to be addressed. Really, I do. Do I? No. How about no? To hell with you. I'm not doing that. It has nothing to do with whether you're transsexual. I could care less whether you're transsexual, as long as you're not particularly annoying. And that's the same way I feel about everyone else. It's like, do whatever you want. I'm pretty libertarian in that regard. But don't take your identity. You don't have any right to impose your identity on other people to the point where your arguments pose a threat to the fundamental structures of Western civilization. It's like, you're pushing your luck a little bit there.
There's also the arguments that referring to trans people by the pronouns of their choice will improve their social standing or their mental well-being, but you don't believe...
There's no evidence for any of that. And there's no evidence, but these people don't give a damn about evidence, and they'd never bother doing a study. We know some literature on this. There is literature. When I released the paper that I'm publishing with Christine Brophy on political correctness, it's reviewed in that. We're working very hard on that paper right now, and we've replicated it, and replicated very well. The evidence that exists, which is rather minimal, suggests that forcing people to use politically correct terminology actually increases bias. And there's certainly no evidence at all that that can be trained away. But there is evidence. I wouldn't say it's overwhelmingly strong, but the evidence that does exist makes exactly the opposite claim. Plus, look, if you're going to carry around with you a set of complex linguistic demands with a legal punch behind them, how the hell do you expect that to help you integrate more easily into normative society? It's a preposterous claim. So, and the other thing that I'd like to say about that is that who the hell said that these activists are speaking for transsexuals? I've spoken to a bunch of transsexuals who say, nope, they're not speaking for me. So Theron Meyer, for example, we had quite a detailed conversation, quite a good conversation. We actually managed to talk about some difficult things. She doesn't want gender-neutral pronouns. Who the hell wants this? Most transsexuals, especially the classic type, who are gender dysphoric from a very young age, they have no problem with he or she. They just want to be the other one. And you can debate about the utility of that. The evidence from the Johns Hopkins Gender Reassignment Clinic, which they shut down, which was originated, by the way, by John Money, who was the deluded son of a bitch who decided that gender identity and biological sex were separate to begin with. They shut the Gender Reassignment Clinic down because the consequences of surgical reassignment were absolutely catastrophic. So anyways, there's no evidence that these trans activists that are pushing for gender-neutral pronouns are valid representatives of the trans community. So they say all the time, and that's what social justice warrior political correct authoritarians always do, oh, we stand for the oppressed. It's like, who the hell says you stand for the oppressed? Just because you're black doesn't make you a representative of black people. No more than me being white makes me a representative of white people. So unless we're going to play the identity politics game and reduce everyone to their ethnicity. And I don't even know how we're going to do that. It's like, everyone has multiple identities. How do you know where to classify them? I mean, what just out of curiosity, what's your ethnic background?
Both my parents are Iranian.
Okay. So are you Iranian or English?
I was born in the UK.
Okay. So, but if I was going to classify you, which I wouldn't, but if I was going to, it's like, what the hell am I going to do with you? You're a bearded guy. There's one classification, or two, I guess. You know, are you an Englishman? Are you an oppressor? Or are you a victim? I mean, if you're Iranian, well, I suppose it depends on the historical context. You know, you could be an oppressor or a victim. Pick your role there. But you're an Englishman, so, oh, for sure, you're an oppressor. It's like, I don't know what to do with you. I don't know whether to punish you for being a perpetrator or feel sorry for you because you're a victim. So this group identity classification thing is it's an assault on individual responsibility. You know, one of the tenets of Western civilization is you judge people as individuals, and you also judge them by their damn intent, not by the consequences of their actions. And the political PC authoritarians are going all out to assault, they're conducting an all-out assault on that idea too. You know, they're bringing the consideration of consequences into the law. Doesn't matter what you meant when you said that. It matters how the person felt. It's like, Jesus, how the hell am I supposed to control how you feel? Mm-hmm. I have no idea how to do that. I mean, I offend people. I offend my wife all the time because I say something that she misunderstands, or I speak badly, or I'm saying something, you know, that where I haven't got my motivations entirely straight, and she's offended and I think it's accidental, but it turns out that when we discuss it, it was actually purposeful. It's like, it's a mess, man.
I think it's important to say that from my experience, and I know from the experience that others have detailed, the majority of students are not, you know, PC ideologues, but many of the people in positions of power within universities, and I'm talking about amongst the student body, are. How has that come to be the case, in your view?
That's a good question. Well, I would say people who have personality problems tend to preferentially seek authority because it's easier for them to blame the structure and change other people than it is to deal with their own personal problems. I mean, I saw this going back all the way to when I was in college back in 1979, I was on the student government, and there were some seriously pathological people in the student government at Grand Prairie Regional College, where I did my first 2 years. And then I also had some contact with the student organizations at the provincial and national level. And, you know, there were many, 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 many troubled people who were operative already at that point. And so, and then, so some of that's just change others instead of changing. It's not me that has the problem, it's everyone else. So I'm going to adopt, I'm going to chase political power, especially if it doesn't require much work. And then I'm going to jump up and down until I get my way. But then it's more pervasive than that now, because these social justice warrior, PC authoritarian disciplines like women and gender studies have trained hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of activists to do exactly that, to occupy positions of power. And so that's what they've done. And that's partly why, the universities need to be shaken up. But it's also a massive problem. I have no idea what we're going to do about it. Call them out on their behavior, I guess. I'm going to, partly what I want to do with this website is I'm going to set it up so that people can upload politically correct policies from, we're going to do state by state in the US, province by province in Canada, and try to do the same sort of analysis for Europe and New Zealand and Australia. Allow people to upvote or to upload politically correct policies and legislation. Allow people to vote on whether or not they're politically correct, so that we can identify the ones that really are politically correct. And then also see if we can find out who the hell it is that's promoting these doctrines and identify them. Because I don't see any other way to do it.
What do you think is the best way to teach students in order to toughen them up for the wider world?
Oh, well, that's what a classical education was for. You know, I mean, read real books. That's the, you know, I put some reading list on my webpage, jordanbpeterson.com. Students should be reading horrifying books, Paradise Lost, Dante's Inferno. Those are so classics, and classics of mythology as well. Those things are rough, man. They deal with, the Old Testament's a good example of that. They deal with all manners of the horrors of human existence. And then, say, if you're thinking about more recent books, well, there's all sorts of great books that have been written about the horrors of the 20th century. I would say great literature, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. There's a massive literature on the Holocaust, books like Ordinary Men, which details the transformation of a police battalion, a German police battalion that was sent into Poland after the Nazis marched through to establish order, roughly speaking. These were just ordinary middle-class men that had been raised in Germany prior to the rise of the Nazis. So they're just typical bourgeois individuals, I would say, very much like you and me, undoubtedly. And it details, and their commandant, their commander, was quite a humane manager. He told them that they were going to be required to do some nasty things that were outside of normal police work, but that they could leave and go home if they felt that they weren't up to it. And none of them did. And part of that was camaraderie and their lack of desire to leave their comrades, let's say, their colleagues in arms, to do the dirty work. Well, so it details the transformation of these men from ordinary and decent fathers into killers who were taking pregnant women out into fields, stripping them naked and shooting them in the back of the head. And, you know, these men were made physically ill by their own transformation. They were vomiting. They lost weight. They were nervous wrecks because of what they were training themselves to do. So, like, read that and tremble, because that's a description of what a human being is like. You know, you think it was the Nazis, you think it was the Soviets. That's rubbish. It was you. And if you don't understand that, then you're weak and uninformed and dangerous. And so what I teach my students, and I do my best to teach them this, is that if you would have been in Germany in the 1930s, you would have been a Nazi. And maybe you would have been an Auschwitz camp guard of the sort that had the inmates take 100-pound sacks of wet salt, carry them from one side of the compound, and then carry them back. It's like, you don't think you're capable of torturing people like that? Well, then you're naive. And so the only way you're going to be the only way you're going to learn about what you're really like is to be terrified right down to the bottom of your soul. And if you're not, if that isn't happening in the humanities and the social sciences, then they're not doing their job. And if your university teachers aren't terrifying you, then you should abandon their classes and go into the sciences.
One thing you said in an interview that I quite liked was that you like your students to be a little terrified of you. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, why shouldn't they be? Why shouldn't they be? I'm not a particularly... look, temperamentally, I'm pretty agreeable, despite what you might think. I actually regard it as somewhat of a character flaw. I tend to give people the benefit of the doubt, and I would say that I'm somewhat more trusting than I should be. Now, it's tough because I do think that trust is absolutely vital. But there's a difference between naive trust, and that's the trust you have because you don't know any better. You're like a puppy. You know, oh, everyone's good. It's like, no, they're not. Mature trust is courage. I'm going to trust you because I want to extend a hand out to you so that we can cooperate, so that we don't have to fight, so that we can build something together. But I know that you're a pit of snakes, and I know that I'm a pit of snakes, but I'm going to be courageous and trust you nonetheless. That's the sort of trust you want to aim for. But agreeableness, the trait of agreeableness, makes you naively trusting, and I'm actually quite high in agreeableness. But you know, Nietzsche said, if you gaze long into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. Nietzsche said, beware that when fighting monsters, you yourself do not become a monster. For when you gaze long into the abyss also gazes into you. Yeah, well, that's me. I've gazed into an abyss for a very long time. I've immersed myself in the study of the horrors that human beings are capable of perpetrating upon one another. And I recognize in myself the same kind of perpetrator. And so I know that of myself. And so why shouldn't my students be afraid of me? They should be afraid of themselves too. And so that doesn't mean that I'm a terrible person. But the only reason it doesn't mean that is because I'm a terrible person who has himself under control. That's all. And I'm not naive, not in the least. And so there's no reason that students should assume that I'm a puppy dog. And that my goal is to make them feel safe and comfortable. That is absolutely 100% not my goal. My goal is to terrify them enough so that there's some possibility that they'll tell the truth. Because I don't think that you can be, you can't develop sufficient motivation to tell the truth unless you're terrified of hell. And I'm not necessarily speaking metaphysically, although I might also be doing that. There's plenty of hell that can be formulated on earth. And if you know about that hell enough, then you know what you're like. And maybe once you know what you're like, you might be afraid enough to start telling the truth. And that's what I'm trying to do with my students. So I'm not trying to make them safe and comfortable. You know, and that doesn't mean that I'm harsh and dismissive to them or anything like that, because I'm not, not in the least. I like to talk to students. I love my job. I love teaching undergraduates. So, and I have respect for them. You know, I mean, I have respect for the ones that want to learn. I don't care that they're ignorant, but I do care if they're ignorant and ideological, because then they're not ignorant, they're just arrogant. So, but the whole idea that the point of the university is to make people feel secure and comfortable, that is so bloody insane that it's almost unspeakable. It's not a kindergarten. It's not a daycare. It's not a place for fun. It's a place to learn about the human soul. And the human soul is half evil. So, and sometimes a good more than half.
Jordan, thank you.
No problem.